Who owns land? Who can actually prove they own it? Who can build on it? And how should governments manage it? In many fast-growing cities, unclear or overlapping land rights make it risky to invest, difficult to plan infrastructure, and hard for households to use their homes as foundations for economic security. But land reform is no easy feat. It can be politically sensitive, bumping up against many vested interests. There's also issues of history and power, and it can be technically complex too. Welcome to Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev.
And I'm Curtis Lockhart, founder and executive director of the Africa Urban Lab. Today we're asking, what does it actually take to reform land systems at scale? And what can other countries learn from Rwanda's ambitious land tenure reform program, one of the most comprehensive efforts of its kind anywhere in the world? To take us through Rwanda's journey, we're joined here today by Thierry Hoza-Ngoga, who was one of the leading implementers of Rwanda's landmark land regularization program. And he's advised governments across sub-Saharan Africa on land, on agriculture, and on urban development. Thierry, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so just before we get into the Rwandan case, Thierry, can you first tell us, you know, what land reform means in practice? Our listeners, you know, they might hear that phrase and immediately jump to redistribution. So let's just first start with some definitions.
Thank you. I guess it's not bad to think about land reform as land redistribution. I think broader land reform programs or initiatives will have a number of objectives. One is reforming access to land. That would mean possibly giving land to those who have none, therefore the land redistribution aspect you talked about, but also improving access to those who actually want to buy land. If I want to buy land from you, Curtis, for example, how easy that process? The second objective will be about land use. Not everybody owns land, but for those who own it, how are they using it in a productive way? So productive use of land is also part of land reform agenda. And that could take different forms. You know, is it about urban land use? Is it productive agriculture use? Is it industrial use? So it can also depend on different various land use types any country is trying to promote. The third part is actually systems. Are there systems in place that facilitates everything we are talking about? For systems, I'm talking about legal and deregulatory instruments, for example, because land reforms have to be anchored in legal and regulatory systems for landowners, land users, or even potential future land owners to have trust in the systems that their land rights will be protected. And lastly is overall land governance systems. Are there institutions in place whose mandate is actually to support the broader land reform agenda? So that's really how I would sum up any land reform program, but that would vary from one country to another, depending exactly on what the priority of the land reform agendas are. And those could vary from one country to another.
And in fast-growing African cities, we talk a lot about housing shortages, infrastructure gaps, informality, unplanned urban sprawl. From your work, it's clear that dysfunctional land markets are often the ultimate problem underlying these more proximate problems. Can you explain how land reform helps to solve or mitigate all of these other downstream problems that we care about? In particular in African cities?
I think security of tenure is paramount for any urban dwellers, whether you live in informal settlement, whether you live in urban planned areas, or whether you are a potential investor in any urban setup. So ensuring that there is security of tenure, that your land rights will be protected or are guaranteed, I think is priority number one in my view. Second, all of this has to be anchored in legal and regulatory framework that exist. So, you know, if you buy land, actually your land rights will be protected. So the legislator actually takes your land rights into consideration. Third, I would think, is existing of known processes and procedures. I mean, if you travel around many countries or many cities, you would find signposts over what I'll call idle land saying, this plot is not for sale. If you trust, if there is a system in place, if you know your land rights are protected, if you have trust in land administration systems that exist in such cities, you wouldn't be seeing those signposts. So I think for me, that's a big challenge. And I would actually be hesitant to invest in such kind of environment because I know I would be running a risk of losing my investment. So security of tenure, very important. Trusting processes and procedures that exist, the legal and regulatory framework that are functional, so that are actually implemented, but also, and more importantly, having a robust institutional mechanism. In some countries, you don't know where to go if you need to buy land. Such processes don't exist. Or where they exist, you have multiple agencies which have conflicting mandates and becomes quite of a challenge to the urban dwellers who exist in those cities, but also those who are willing to invest in urban development. So once you've gotten this right, definitely you'll have thriving and trusted land market that not only local people will be willing to invest in urban development related programs or projects, but also foreigners, if the regulatory framework allows them to do so, they would definitely be keen to do similar type of investment.
So I was listening to your answer and smirking as you said the people post a lot of signs about this land is not for sale. Last time I was in Nairobi, I went on a 20-minute jog. I saw about 7 of those signs in the same neighborhood. So it is an issue. So just paint the picture for us. I mentioned Rwanda's ambitious land reform program. What were Rwanda's land conditions, before the reforms, especially in urban areas? And what pressures made reform urgent?
Yeah, I was really privileged to be part of that reform agenda. I think my first formal employment was actually working on the Rwanda Land Reform Program. So it's been a privilege just to be part of it. In terms of what existed before the reform started, I won't go back before colonial or even post-colonial Rwanda because, as it will be the case for many countries, customary tenure systems is what characterized most of African countries. I'll just move fast forward to just post-94 genocide against the Tutsi that took place in Rwanda. So you had one big city, that was Kigali City. Kigali City remains the capital of the country. And then you have the rest of the country. Of course, you have few urban areas. But in terms of land management, Kigali City land management was under Kigali City mayor. So the mayor was at the same time the registrar of land titles. The rest of the country's land management systems was under the leadership of the ministry responsible for land. So any titles that were issued on urban land outside Kigali would be signed by the minister in charge of land. But for Kigali City, everything fell under the management of Kigali City mayor. And in terms of broader urban land management, I would say Kigali had a lot of planned areas. As any colonial city, of course, you had colonial administration areas that were well planned. They still exist. But that was very limited to specific areas. Majority of Kigali City was considered unplanned. I remember at the time they were talking about 70%, which is a common figure really across many African countries. 70% of land in Kigali City were unplanned. So broadly, you had limited number of parcels that were titled. So very limited number of land was titled. Now, fast forward, after the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi, I think Rwanda embarked on a broader transformation agenda. And the pressure you're talking about actually came from within. What Rwanda wanted to see in its long-term development horizon. So Rwanda set out this ambitious 2020 vision, which had land reform as one of its pillars. And I think that's a big lesson to learn, because in many cases you find land reform as an isolated program on the side. It's not part of the broader economic transformation. So Rwanda had that as its one of the pillars that would lead to achieving a 2020 vision. The second part was, of course, the tragic past that the country had faced. How do you manage IDPs, internally displaced people? How do you manage those externally displaced refugees? I mean, Rwanda had a vague of refugees since the 50s. People who had fled the country in the 50s, they were now returning because peace had restored. So how do you mitigate potential land-related conflict? So that was another factor that actually pushed Rwanda to profile land reform as one of the critical development agenda. And thirdly, I think more importantly, is how do you ensure that the limited land resources that the country has is really used to support this growing population? Rwanda is not a big country. It's one of the smallest, I would say, countries in Africa with a high population rise. And the majority of them depends on land for their livelihood. So putting land at the center of every development agenda, I think, was a key priority for government. So I would really sum up as some of the factors that pushed Rwanda to reform as quickly as it could to ensure that the limited land resources is not only used to support those who depend on it, but also it's used to actually, I would say, inject energy into the broader economic transformation the country had embarked on.
Great. And when you look, I guess, across other countries in Africa that you've worked in, Thierry, what parts of Rwanda's sort of starting point feel familiar to you? And then on the other side, what parts were most different from the Rwandan case?
I think what's familiar is there is this linear approach. You know, you have to have a policy in place, you have to have a law in place, and then everything else will stem from there. When you go in many African countries, either they, you know, you find countries sending delegates to other countries to learn from their land reform agenda. You will find multilateral organization funding legal reforms related to land. So having a policy, having a legal and regulatory framework in place, and establishing land management institutions, it's something you find across many countries. And of course, Rwanda embarked on a similar approach. But I guess the uniqueness of Rwanda, as I said earlier, was its tragic past. I think that was a bigger factor. The second, which I really believe is also quite unique to Rwanda compared to some African countries I've worked in, land agenda is a national priority, is a national project. What that means, it's not the responsibility of one entity. It's the entire government machinery, from central government to local government, across sectoral coordination, you have land as an agenda. This is big, in my view, based on what I see across many countries. In some countries, when you travel, ministries of land are the understaffed ministries. They are put in old buildings, and sometimes they are not really well equipped enough to handle this big mandate. But once it is prioritized, you know, it's even it's given equal opportunity, equal resources, and priorities from these sectors are taken into consideration by other sectors. You can't develop an agriculture-based economy if land tenure security is not put at the forefront of everything the country does. You can't urbanize effectively if land issues aren't sorted. So in a nutshell, what I'm trying to say, Rwanda prioritized this agenda and put it in its unique position. And I think the other element I already talked about is being a national priority meant that everybody has to be brought together, including the beneficiaries. As you'd know, the Rwanda Land Reform Program was public-led. So you wouldn't only parachute people from Kigali and say, go and do demarcation and adjudication across the country. No, empower those who are meant to benefit from this program and ensure actually there is buy-in. So the uniqueness of Rwanda Land Reform Program also stemmed from the fact that land reform was demanded. There was receptiveness by landowners to see this change happen. And I think that puts it in a unique position. But there could be many other factors which can't be captured on this podcast.
Can you walk us through the reform as a sequence? So you've talked a bit about kind of how the people were demanding this change and there was a lot of momentum. But how did Rwanda go from this policy idea to actually the result of millions of parcels being registered? And what were kind of the key phases in that process?
Yeah, so after the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi, Rwanda embarked on national dialogues where the country was trying to see what could be its transformational journey. What kind of priority sectors should Rwanda put forward? And from those consultations, which involved a wide range of stakeholders, land was identified as one priority area. And of course, that made it into the Rwanda 2020 vision. Now, fast forward, as a result of this, because there was no policy, Rwanda had to set guidelines. What do we want to see to govern land in the most productive way possible? So the national land policy was set out. And as every other policy provides broader guidelines. This is the government position. This is the government ambition. That was 2005, the policy was also supported by the organic land law. Now, this is a legislation that categorizes different types of land use, sets out different legislation on how land will be governed, who will do what, the type of land use that will be in place in the country, so recognizing what exists, but also introducing new ones. But as we know, policy and laws don't necessarily define how. They often talk about what in broader terms. But when it comes to dividing those into chunks of interventions on the ground, they're rather silent. Now, what happened next was to try and see, can we test these two instruments, the policy and the law? One, does the public really understand these two instruments exist? Two, are they really willing to embark on what is proposed under these two pieces of legislation? Is there any receptiveness to change the way people hold their land? Are people really willing to have land titles, you know, have their land documented, demarcated and documented? Is it just only government ambition or is it just something that's demanded from within? So that's why I'm saying I was fortunate just to embark on this program. As I joined when the law had been passed and there was a very small team that was put together, and we ran consultation across the country. And I think we spoke to 17, if I remember very well, different types of groups. And there was an overwhelming, support to the reform agenda that the country had embarked on. And they were willing to get land documented. there was a thriving, informal thriving land market, even in rural areas, people exchanging land, and they had their own agreement. Because part of the consultation, we also wanted to understand the kind of systems that exist in terms of land markets when landowners are transacting land rights. How do they do it? What kind of documentations that exist? How secure is that documentation? I mean, it was fascinating to see some of these groups, different districts, had their own ways of recording land rights. Based on the pilot, the outcome of the pilot, the outcome of the consultation, now Rwanda was able to embark on drafting some of the initial secondary legislation supported by the result of the pilot exercise that was undertaken. By the pilot exercise, I meant, yes, there are these policy, there is the law, there is the outcome of the consultation. People want to see change. Now, how do you do that? How do you go about implementing them? So the country embarked on a land pilot, land registration pilot exercise that ended with the registration of 14,000 different parcels across four districts. And these four districts were representative of the country as a whole. You know, we had urban areas, peri-urban areas, completely rural areas, but also areas where land holdings were deemed to be slightly larger than everywhere else. The selected four pilot areas deemed to represent the reality in the country. And fast forward, the pilot demonstrated that actually it was possible to register land. The public buying was very strong. And we came up with technical tools that were needed to support this journey. But more importantly, the outcome that came out of the pilot was used to draft the secondary legislation or additional legal instrument that then defined the how. So you're moving from the what, the ambition that's described into the policy and the organic land law, to now defining the how things will be taking place on the ground. And that was an amazing phase. And from that, there was a roadmap that defined the rollout of the National Land Regularization Program. So, and as we speak now, I think the bigger focus now is how do you maintain what exists at the moment?
A lot of land reforms fail, but one of the key themes of your answers so far has been that Rwanda had this extensive process of consulting people. There was a lot of demand for this reform to happen. And it seems like you found ways to really effectively involve the public in this process. Is there anything that stands out to you that was kind of a particularly effective way that the Rwandan government was able to speak to people and figure out what they wanted and what their preferences were?
Yeah, I would say the fact that the reform was evidence-based. By evidence-based is you are actually involving people, not necessarily as beneficiaries only, but also as actors. When we talk about community-led exercise, literally from demarcation, which is demarcating land boundaries on these maps, it was done by locally trained people. If it's about recording land rights, it's like who owns what? Who owns this piece of land? Where are the land boundaries? Who else has interests in this piece of land? It was all done by local people. So on one hand, they are not only beneficiaries, but they are also actors. And I think that increases trust because they know the end result is to secure their land rights. Nobody else is doing it on their behalf, but they are doing it themselves. So enabling them, empowering them to take the lead, I think, made the receptiveness and the buying quite straightforward. The second part is, of course, affordability, which makes it also, in a way, unique. Those who couldn't afford, government subsidized them. Even those who couldn't afford, the fee were quite minimal. It wasn't big, fat price or cost these people were incurring. And the approach itself forced people to talk to each other. And through that process, there is that element of building trust. There is that element of forcing each other to actually resolve disputes that arise. Because, Oliver, put it this way, you are neighbors with Curtis. I come as a parasurveyor who grew up in the same neighborhood. I already know where your land boundary is. And I'm asking you to, can you guys show me where your boundaries are? We are already familiar. I may not like you, but we live in the same village. He made it easier because people who were actors, at the same time beneficiaries, were actually the ones rolling out this exercise. And I think that really helped. That really helped the whole process. But also, this was a learning by doing exercise. You know, where there were no systems in place, where there were no tools that had been developed to cater for some surprises, people were willing to sit and discuss and find solutions that work for those challenges that we encountered. So I think that really made it easier for everybody. And everybody felt, I can't remember the figures, but I remember by the time we finished demarcation and adjudication, the entire land reform program had employed 1% of the entire Rwandan population. I mean, that's massive. Literally, that's big. It shows how big and participatory the exercise was.
And you touched upon learning by doing. I know in the process of doing an actual implementation, there's always like unexpected events that crop up, right? So I guess during this consultation and implementation of a land reform, were there anything that occurred that policymakers didn't anticipate? What were those things?
I think a lot of them will be very technical, I would say. I think the number one, which I vividly remember, because when we're doing the trial land registration exercise, the first parcel we tried to demarcate was owned by a polygamous man. And by constitution, Rwanda recognizes one legally married wife, you know? I mean, nobody had thought about this. And it happens that the first plot that we were trying to demarcate to understand how best the techniques we had were going to work was owned by a polygamous woman. I don't think anybody envisaged that to be the case. Secondly, I would say, you know, Rwanda is a very small country, quite hilly, but also had smaller islands across. Some of these islands are privately owned, but there was no clarity around how do you register an island, you know, even when some of these islands are owned by, you know, private individuals. That also hadn't really been planned. Nobody had anticipated that to be a challenge. I would also say the demarcation part was largely driven by the use of satellite imagery. So Rwanda commissioned satellite imagery with high resolution, but in some areas it was very cloudy, so you couldn't actually see on the image where land passes away. So that was really another challenge that hadn't been anticipated. And now when it comes to urban areas, the so-called informal settlement, I mean, houses are just next to each other, are congregated together. It's not easy just to see that physical boundary. Absolutely difficult. So some of these were really challenges that nobody had really anticipated. And that forced people to sit and learn, how do we go by addressing this challenge? And the critical part, Rwanda had no typical model that we were learning from. It wasn't like, okay, the neighboring Kenya or Uganda, Tanzania, or any country five field had done this exercise. Let's see how they dealt with this. It was just more just forcing people to sit together and say, okay, this is what we are faced. How do we go about this? And there was a sense of community feel even within, you know, the technical team, the government team, the development partners team. They all speak the same language, just coming together. How do we sort this out? So it was a learning by doing exercise.
And land reform can potentially change power structures in a society. So were there clear winners and losers to this? And I guess what were the main political bottlenecks to getting this reform done?
Anywhere you have loopholes, there will always be winners and losers. And I think the biggest losers would be those that were, in a way, using the loopholes that existed to, you know, either acquire land illegally or just use whatever means possible to use the loopholes to make themselves, you know, rather comfortable or big landowners, whatever you may call it. Anyone who profited from the status quo, in my view, would be a loser. But I would say broadly, there were more winners than losers. If you look at an ordinary Rwandan, often, who's been orphaned by the genocide against the Tutsi, who today has a land title guaranteeing their land rights, they know where to go if a conflict arises. They can transact their land easily because there are clear systems, procedures that are known. If you have a woman who never inherited land before, but now they have their land, they have their names recorded on a land title. If you have a foreigner wanting to invest in Rwanda and they have that security of tenure, they know where to go, whether they know the local systems or not, but they know where to go because systems, processes and procedures are very clear to them, as they are very clear to locals. If you have now, I would say now, more than 15 different institutions using the land registration record as the backbone of some of the sector's development, I mean, it's amazing to see how many winners are there. Was this part of what was anticipated before the land reform started? Maybe yes and maybe no. But because this was part of the broader economic transformation journey Rwanda wanted to embark on, there are more winners than losers, I would say. Because, there is nothing like feeling if you pass on today, your kids won't be bothered by anybody else wanting to take their land away because there is that legal instrument that shows their land rights, because they are that land registry that's trusted. I mean, that trust is extremely critical for anyone wanting to invest in land, whether in urban areas or rural areas, or anyone wanting to acquire land for investment in the short or longer term. So broadly, many, many winners than losers.
Great. And let's just put some numbers on Rwanda's land reform for listeners. So you managed to register over 10 million parcels across Rwanda with over 7 million titles issued in less than 5 years. And I think crucially, you managed to do this at a cost of only $6 per parcel, right? So I looked up some figures. And so meanwhile, Tanzania across the border attempted a similar type of land regularization program. And I think the cost clocked in at about $3,000 per parcel. So, I mean, first, how did you carry out the Rwanda program so cost effectively? Number one. And then second, what explains this just massive variation that we observe in costs across land reform programs?
Yeah, the program was quite speedy because it was quite systematic. As I mentioned, community-led and, you know, the workforce that was involved, up to 1% of the entire Rwandan population. I think that's quite massive. It's not necessarily typical of many land reforms in many African countries. So the fact that it was community-led, the fact that it was quite systematic, using basic technologies, but that were efficient, that meant that actually it was affordable. And the fact that the intention of the government was actually to ensure security of tenure for all. Therefore, the interest of government to charge more money wasn't going to be a priority for government to make land registration a money-making business. Now, what makes this case unique to many countries? I think I know of a few countries, and I'm not naming them, but you have survey-related work only given to a very small number of accredited or certified surveyors. And that's big. And it's legislated that only certified surveyors, and you have that number. And they make the certification of surveyors so difficult that you finish university, you qualify as a surveyor, but you can't get that certification because they want that monopoly. They also make surveying land very expensive. They would have what is known as fixed boundary surveys. You know, you bring all these cement concrete known as beacons, and you want to place them in every single corner of each plot. I mean, one, that's very expensive in terms of financial cost, but also in terms of time it takes. In Rwanda, it could easily have taken maybe a day to register 600 parcels, as an example, because it's done by local people who are trained. They may not have that level of education, but they have what it takes to know where the boundaries are. And I think that's what mattered. Now, you have other countries where what matters is the accuracy. You know, they don't want to lose 20 centimeters or 1 meter. And that's what they fight about. So again, it depends on the priority. Does this really matter? Or what matters is to bring every single piece of land onto the register. That makes it complex, and it takes forever to get this exercise completed. So the figures you are quoting, I'm not surprised. Maybe if you go now into how long does it take, you pay that $3,000, but you can also ask how long does it take to get land title. Now, for business perspective, will I really be wanting to do business where not only I have to pay money, but also I have to wait forever for me to secure a land document or a land lease? So again, that stems from what is the broader ambition of doing land reform? What do people really want to achieve? What does government really want to achieve with broader land reform agenda? I think that would be the starting point that then dictates what happens downstream. Because if it's a prioritized national agenda, definitely those factors in terms of cost, time, will be taken into consideration and will be dealt with for the benefit of everybody.
And you've already talked a bit about what happened once the reform was implemented in terms of the security that people felt, knowing they would be able to hand over their land to their kids or just feel secure in their ownership of the land. Thinking a bit more broadly about the economy as a whole, what sort of economic benefits did Rwanda experience once this program was finished?
Very good question. And I don't know whether that study has really taken place, but I would love, you know, a study that looks into exactly addressing your question. So I'll give you my personal opinion based on what I see. For landowners, benefits are multifaceted. One, I talked about women. I think this is important because traditionally women were not known as a group that could inherit land from their fathers or even from their husbands. But today, they have that security of tenure. If they are legally married, 50% share is theirs. They can transact. Actually, now the National Land Register figures show that women as sole owners of land are the majority of owners in the National Land Register. I think that's fascinating. So the ability to transact freely, I think for me, that's a huge benefit. And of course, land value. Land value has increased. Again, because this land reform agenda was coupled by broader economic transformation. So access to infrastructure in many areas where there was no development. Now you see roads. They don't have to be tarmacked roads, but those roads exist. And in some cases, they are tarmacked. Once they are tarmacked, of course, they add value. Even to the informal settlement, owners are forced, in a way, they see incentives to upgrade their own dwellings. So there is the aspect of security, which is critical. There is aspect of land value. There is aspect of trusting the system in place. I'm sorry, I'm coming back to trust because I think that's the critical part. Many countries are currently facing, many urban dwellers not trusting systems that exist. And that actually becomes a stumbling block for their potential investment in housing, for example. And of course, having clear legal and regulatory framework and very strong institutions that are mandated to carry out this exercise. Now, from the state's perspective or government perspective, revenue generation is key. I think there are now streamlined processes of actually generating land-based revenues, being tax on land. These land-based revenues are categorized based on, you know, prime location, infrastructure and services that these landowners benefit from, but also delivering services to the public expectation. Governments have the mandate to provide services to those who need it. Now, when they have streamlined processes, when land-based disputes are no longer, their everyday business, it doesn't mean they are not there. They are there, but at least there are ways of addressing them that are streamlined. And of course, land value capture. I mean, it'll be interesting to see whether, you know, there are better ways of capturing, you know, additional land value and then reinvesting this. That's why I was saying it'll be fascinating to see what kind of study that could be done. Now, after the reform, maybe 10 years is good time enough to actually go back and see how impactful this land reform agenda has been to the broader economic transformation of the country.
Now, the economist Hernando de Soto, he has this well-known thesis that, you know, once land tenure is regularized at scale, we'd observe a significant increase in the number of households using this newly cleared title as collateral, and then in turn enhancing their ability to access credit at affordable rates. So, I mean, you may not know this yet, or the study may not have been done, but just from your observations, did you see this de Soto thesis play out in Rwanda?
I think the lender won't only use a land title as a basis for lending money. Of course, a land title brings that certainty, that security that the lender needs, but it's not sufficient. I think the lender is looking at different things. Is looking at the ability of the borrower to pay back. That's one. Is looking at active land market. If the borrower defaults, are we able to sell this land and recoup our money? So there are many factors that will dictate what the borrower does. But I wouldn't negate the value of a land title in securing mortgage. But it's not enough to make sure that mortgage are given. However, if you look around Rwandan urban areas, I mean, the housing development sector is booming. And definitely majority of these owners are using their land certificates as collateral in a bank. But most of these people are already employees. They have secured employment. So if they default, the bankers already know that actually they can get the money back. There is a sense of security for the bankers to take that risk to lend to these people to secure a mortgage. But it's not the only determining factor that will lead banks to lend them money. There are many other factors I've mentioned. Interestingly, if you go into rural areas, you have microfinance, as it is in many countries. You don't necessarily have the typical classic banks penetrating the remote rural areas, not only in Rwanda, but also in broader African continent. You do find that actually landowners are using their land certificate as a collateral to secure small loans, small business loans for their businesses. So it's happening. But if I had a title and I have 20 acres of land in so remote areas, will a banker give me money because I have that title? No. The banker will be giving me money because they know that land is prime. They know that land will be sold back and maybe they'll be able to recoup their money. So what I'm trying to say is land titling is not the only factor. It is a factor, but it's not the only factor that will lead banks to lend money to those who have land titles. But definitely the land market in Rwanda is booming because of so many factors I've already spoken about, and mortgage is one of the key factors leading to urban development project, housing project, as we are seeing them currently in Kigali and other secondary cities.
Historically, some of the most successful land reforms occurred in East Asia. And famously, East Asia has managed to balance both a rapid urban transition phenomenally well. Do you think there are some key lessons that fast-growing African cities today can learn from the Asian experience around land reform?
Yeah, I think so. I think Asia is quite close to Africa culturally. There are so many elements that are quite common, but also typical challenges that, you know, the two sides of the world have really faced. There is a sense of similarities, but also broader uniqueness across these two continents. Now, coming to your question, what I would say is, I believe there is. One is what I think Asian countries have done well that potentially Africans could learn from them is clarifying land ownership and security of tenure. I think that's priority number one in urban areas. They have also been able actually to integrate, which is very interesting, integrate informal land holdings, informal and customary tenure. I think this is, again, very important. Because when you look at urban development in Africa, Southern African countries and West African countries where customary tenure is still very, very important, there is a huge divide. You have urban areas governed by central government, and then you have rural areas broadly governed by customary leadership. And these two don't speak to each other. There's a natural divide. And if you're looking at urban expansion, you're only going to expand into customary tenure systems. Now, how do you bring them together? I think Asian countries have been able actually to do it, and it's a potential lessons to learn from them. And also linked to that is the divide between urban and rural areas. If you focus on developing urban areas, pressure from rural areas is going to be so big in urban areas that you can't handle it. Now, how do you distribute resources across urban areas as well as rural areas to ensure that that pressure is contained? Realistic urban planning, it's extremely important. I think planning well, but also planning within the context of the country's economic ambitions and reality is something we can learn from these Asian countries. I think this is very important because if you look at many cities across Africa, they have ambitious urban plans. It's good to have a plan, but it will only be a plan until it is implemented. So implementation is always a challenge because a lot of efforts are put into designing plans, but then enforcement isn't that empowered. So you have maybe two or three staff only in charge of enforcement, but also they're enforcing a plan that's not necessarily grounded into the city's own reality. I'm managing a city somewhere in Africa. I travel to London. I see how London is thriving as a city. I go back because I'm a mayor. I commission a study, commission a plan. I'm like, this is what I want. I want London erected somewhere in Africa. But it's London. It's an economic powerhouse. The kind of economy London is running is not what you have in your own country. So being able to design plans that are based on local reality, I think it's what, again, Asian countries have done well. And the aspect of development control, I think this is very, very important because if you are also able to design the periphery urban planning where urban expansions are going to take place, you service these areas first, you are adding value. And of course, when this land is occupied, the land value capture, the additional value you've added, those resources are used to reinvest into various socio-economic infrastructure. That's another aspect of land value capture, which I believe can actually be learned from these countries. And again, the institutional framework is very strong. There is strong coordination. They speak the same language. And again, similar to what I was talking about when I said the Rwanda national reform was more of a national agenda. You had the same consistency of messaging. And I think similar to Asia, there is no dysfunctional coordination. They're very well coordinated from central, regional to local level. The message is the same. But today, if you look at some of these African cities, you have the ministry responsible for urban development and broader land use planning across the country, but they don't have the same message as the one the mayor is passing. It's a dissimilar message to the one a local chief is passing. And these are entities responsible to be literally doing the same stuff, but the message is completely different. And that sends wrong signals. So I believe there are so many lessons. And of course, you know, this part of the world is very unique. But there are some general lessons I think could be learned from there based on what I've discussed.
So some listeners may look outside Rwanda and say, you kind of alluded to this, and say the national rollout of land regularization that you spearheaded in Rwanda isn't likely to work as effectively elsewhere, right? So having said this, what are some, let's say, second best approaches to nationwide land regularization that perhaps might be more feasible in more capacity constrained African contexts? And feel free to talk about the national level or the city level.
Yeah, I think it doesn't have to be a broader or holistic national land reform program. It could be localized reform. And I believe you don't necessarily have to have a policy and a law in place to be able to start the reform agenda. You can start small. You can start with one municipality, for example, when it's all about recording land rights. Develop smaller approaches in smaller areas and lessons from those experiment are then scaled at national level. In every country, there are powerhouse regions, there are economic transformation areas or regions. So what I'm trying to say, there are areas where people are ready to pay. There are areas where government is prioritizing certain development agenda. It's an agro-industrialization park. It's an urban areas that, you know, government wants to develop. Government can start from those areas. It doesn't necessarily have to take a holistic nationwide approach. For me, I think this is something that can be done. The other point I mentioned is putting in place a law and a policy can take forever. And some politicians who are not committed, who are not putting the national cause before their personal interest, don't necessarily invest in long-term programs. They prefer short-term gains so they can be re-elected once again. So it takes boldness to embark on broader reform agenda. Now, if that's not the case, start small. Because if you start small, you perfect your model, you design it in a way that is, you know, building on the reality on the ground. It's starting from areas where people can afford. So prioritize areas and move slowly. I think that's possible. Another area I would just say, there is so much in terms of technology now. You know, I talked about how we did this work in Rwanda. Now you have drones that can do mapping. You have a lot of emerging technologies that could actually make this exercise cost effective. Now, how can you leverage what exists to apply that into a small geographical area? I think, again, that requires a visionary leader willing just to put, you know, interest of the general public before his own interest and say, I'm going to try it. I will fail forward, but I'm just going to try it. So I think it doesn't have to take the Rwanda path. Rwanda is unique in its many ways, but Rwanda presents good learning opportunities for many countries that are actually willing to learn. You know, we talk about political will. Everybody can talk about our political will, but it has to move from those political pronouncements to doing actions on the ground. And I think, you know, whether it's a mayor, you know, working with local chiefs, whether it's just local. I know some local chiefs who have similar initiatives actually in their own chiefdom. They are willing, they are progressive, they see opportunities, and they are willing to embark on that journey. Now, how do you support a progressive chief to do that? And once it's done, definitely the next door chief will want to do the same because they'll start seeing the benefit. So, That's really what I would say in that regard.
And I wanted your take on this, Thierry, because I've spoken with several officials from Ministry of Lands in various countries, and an issue around land titling that they bring up is that often they report that there's actually little demand for the actual land title. So, for example, I've heard on multiple occasions from these officials, okay, we have these titling programs and we spend all this money doing the cadastral surveys to do this titling. And then when it's all done, no one comes and, you know, demands the actual land title. But some research I know has shown that if you install some urban infrastructure and do some proactive urban planning and minimal servicing, as you alluded to, property values of nearby plots will significantly increase, right? And this land value uplift actually seems to increase the demand for title a lot, right? To protect against expropriation of a now much more valuable asset. So this is all to say, how do you think about fixing this no demand for title problem?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think there have to be more incentives than just a land title. So the point you talked about, you know, having serviced area, it has to be more than just that set title. I'll just give you an example. When we started this campaign in Rwanda, I remember being in one part in Rwanda, rural Rwanda, and I remember this old man asking me, and I think he called me young man, which definitely I'm still young, but in his eyes, I was even very, very young. Like, why do I need a piece of paper? Everyone in this area knows this is my land. My neighbors know that this is my land. Why should I go and just get this piece of paper? I mean, that was a fascinating question. Did I have an answer? No, I had no answer. But I just said, imagine if you're no longer alive, would the same apply to your grandchildren? Because everybody now knows you are the owner. But if you're no longer there, would the neighbors recognize your grandchildren as the owners of this land? How would you want them to be protected? Now he started thinking, but with all honesty, I did not have the right answer to that question. I just asked this question because I knew we were faced with a number of orphans, some of whom did not even know where their land boundaries are. So for them, it was paramount to have a piece of paper that shows their land rights so they can be protected. Now, in your case, your question is very important, especially when it comes to urban areas. If people don't trust the system, because it's not about issuing a title, I've also seen cases where one plot has 4-5 different land titles, authentic land titles. People will never come if they don't trust the system in place. A title in itself doesn't guarantee that security they want to see. They have to have trust in the system that's issuing those titles. They have to have guarantees that actually their land rights will be protected, not only by that piece of paper, because that can be challenged in court, especially where you have double issuance of titles on the same plot. But they have to have incentives, because at the end of the day, they want to develop them. So everybody wants better livelihood. That's the bottom line. But if that land title is the only thing that municipality is putting forward, it's going to be hard. But the municipality have got to tell me, yeah, we are also thinking about these are the plans we have to bring water to you guys. We want to make sure there is a transport line in this neighborhood. We want to make sure that electricity that's ending at that side is also coming to you. Now, you are moving from the title conversation to a much broader incentive package that everybody wants to have. So no wonder that in some places, people aren't going for titles, because they also know the minute they have those titles, the tax man will be on their neck the next door. They'll be willing to pay tax or any land-based revenues if they know they are also accessing other facilities or basic amenities. And that stems from the aspect of trust. Do they really think the system in place has got their interests at heart? Or they are doing this land titling reform just for the sake of it? So that will be my long-winded answer to your question, Curtis.
This has been Ideas in Development. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. As always, you can find all previous episodes on the VoxDev website.